Wake up, everyone. It's time for a call to action. Welcome to Call to Action Today, where there are no sacred cows, with your host, Steve Noble, just an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and he's calling you out every week to live the Christian life in your home, your work, and even in politics. Call Steve now at 877-44-TRUTH or check him out online at c2atoday.org. And now, with some much-needed cough medicine for the church, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Well, you've probably heard by now the fundamental Muslims are at it again, this time in Mali, capital city, Mali's capital city. 27 dead. They took over a hotel, had a bunch of hostages, 27 people dead. The descriptions are horrific, as always, just like in Paris and other places around the world. And we've been asking this question recently, of course. What is a good Muslim, a moderate Muslim, a radical Muslim, I happen to think? And this is based on something I'm going to share with you for a decent part of the show today. I mentioned this recently, that for Christians, you know, we wear the little wristband that says WWJD, what would Jesus do? And if you really want to understand Islam and the teachings of the Quran and the Hadith and the Surah and everything else, you have to ask the question, what would Muhammad do? Well, we know what Muhammad did. And so I'm going to share the history of Muhammad here on the show for at least half the show. This will take a while. I've cobbled this together from a bunch of different sources, and these are things that I've read over the years. And this is all in a timeline. It's quite detailed. And so I'm going to take the time, which isn't necessarily a great idea on live radio, but my main concern is the truth and informing and educating you, not whether I'm breaking some rule of radio that says you can't put this much information out there. I happen to think that you're more than capable of handling it, and I hope you can listen to all of it over the next at least half the show. And if not, grab the podcast later and take the time to digest it and listen to the actual historical account of what Muhammad did do. This is Steve Noble. It is Call to Action Radio. C2Atoday.com is the website where you can find the podcasts, of course, and the link to Facebook and Twitter. C2Atoday.com. I'm going to get right into this. And then the second half of the show, we're going to have our friend David Fisher back on, the CEO of Landmark Capital. We're going to be, not this time, but closer to December 15th, when we're going to get an answer out of the Fed about the interest rates, which some people are saying they might raise a little bit, a quarter point. Other people saying not. What happens when they do, if it does happen in December, which would be a real shocker, especially in the middle of the Christmas shopping season. But today we're going to talk about some things developing in Congress that would give our government more access to our investment dollars. We talked about it before. It's called the bail-in. It's happened in 12 other countries, and most notably Malta and Greece and down in that area, where they went in and took a whole lot of money, I think $10,000 out of each person's savings account. They just went in and took it. And that, David Fisher, is called a bail-in. And so we're going to talk to him in the second half of the show at some point when I'm done with the historical account of what Muhammad actually did. Because as I read this to you and as I share this with you, you're going to, what I want you to understand is that, and remember, we mentioned this the other day too, most research shows that only about 20% of Muslims worldwide have read the Quran and are students of it. That's very true of people in America that would call themselves Christians, but really don't know a whole lot about the Bible itself. They're fairly ignorant when it comes to the book they say they're a part of. And much the same for Muslims around the world. And that's why you get this whole division between people that are peace-loving, nice neighbors, wonderful people that you would like to work with and have living in your neighborhood, versus the other ones who would kill you, or at the very least tax you, if you chose not to convert to Islam. And so would the real Islam please stand up? Well, let's read and let's hear about what happened with the founder of Islam himself, of course, Muhammad. While Europe and much of the Middle East was transitioning from the Roman to the Byzantine Empire, with roads, irrigation canals, aqueducts, and a culture that included philosophical discourse and theater, the Arabians lived short and brutal lives in warring tribes with little to offer the rest of the world beyond their own harsh existence. This partly explains Islam's inherent hostility to music and art, which some extremists, such as the Taliban, take quite literally. It is, as Oriana Fallucci puts it, the religion which has produced nothing but religion. Muhammad was born around 570 AD to a widowed mother who died just 6 years later. He grew up poor and orphaned on the margins of society, which was controlled by tribal chiefs and trading merchants. He worked for his uncle as a camel herder. Although his uncle had some standing in the community, Muhammad himself did not rise above his own lowly station until he was 25, when he met and married a wealthy widow, Khadija, who was 15 years older than him. Having attained a comfortable lifestyle and the idle time that wealth affords, Muhammad would wander off occasionally for periods of meditation and contemplation. It is quite likely that he was experiencing the symptoms of a midlife crisis, including a desire for personal accomplishment and meaning. One day, at the age of 40, he told his wife that he had been visited by the angel Gabriel in a dream. Thus began a series of revelations which lasted almost until his death 23 years later. The Quran is a collection of words that Muhammad attributed to Allah when he was told to just write this down. Okay, that's the Quran. The Hadith, another holy book for Islam, is a collection of narrations of the life and the deeds of Muhammad, like a biography, and the Sira is his recorded biography, the Sira. The Sunnah is said to be Muhammad's way of life on which Islamic law or Sharia is based. So you have these four different things, okay? The Quran, the Hadith, the Sira, and the Sunnah. And those are all involved in Islam. With his wife's influence and support, Muhammad proclaimed himself a prophet in the same lineage as that of Abraham and Jesus, and began trying to convert those around him to his new religion. He narrated the Quran to those who believed him, telling them that it was the word of Allah, heard only by himself, of course. Muhammad's Quran did not contain a single original moral value, and it contributed only one new idea to world religion, that Muhammad is Allah's prophet. In fact, Muhammad, Allah, seemed oddly preoccupied with making sure Muslims knew to obey Muhammad's every earthly wish, as this mandate is repeated at least 20 times in the narration of the Quran. At first, Muhammad was only successful with friends and family. After 13 years, the street preacher could boast of only about 100 determined followers who called themselves Muslims. Outside of his wife, his first convert was his young cousin, Ali, who would later become a son-in-law. Another early convert was Abu Bakr, a wealthy merchant whose money and credulous acceptance of Muhammad can be credited with the survival of the fledgling cult. By the way, Muhammad would later marry Abu Bakr's six-year-old daughter. That's where that came from, claiming that God had told him in yet another dream that he was to marry her. And interestingly enough, this is kind of sick. He waited 3 years before having sex with her, so she was nine, because the deal was not until puberty. At nine, please. The death of his uncle Abu Talib in 619 left Muhammad without a protector against the Meccan leadership in Mecca, which was gradually losing patience with him. The true agitator in this situation, however, is quite clearly Muhammad himself, as even Muslim historians note. So when we come back, what happened in Mecca? What happened in Medina? And as as Islam changed and became more radicalized, those are the later parts of the Quran which supersede the earlier parts. And that makes all the difference in the world. This is Steve Noble. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, Call to Action Radio, going through the life and times of Muhammad himself. Of course, the founder of the Islamic religion. And so we're just going right through the timeline of his life to understand what would Muhammad do in today's world. Well, you have to look at what Muhammad did. That's why I'm taking you through this. And again, if you miss any part of it, I'll have the podcast up before I go to bed tonight. That's at c2atoday.com. And you need to make sure you're sharing this. I'll put it up on Facebook so people can hear the actual history of what happened with Muhammad and what he chose to do, because that's what ISIS is doing today. So he's there in Mecca, but they got sick of him after a while. And so that takes him to Medina. Okay. He had made a treaty of war against the Meccans with the people of Medina, another Arab town that was far to the north. This was the last straw for the Meccans, who finally decided to capture Muhammad and put him to death. The year that Muhammad fled Mecca to Medina was 622, which marks the beginning of the Muslim calendar. Stinging from the rejection of his own town and tribe, Muhammad's message quickly became more intolerant and ruthless, particularly as he gained power. Islam's holiest book clearly reflects this contrast, with the latter parts of the Quran adding violence and earthly defeats at the hands of Muslims to the woes of eternal damnation that the earlier parts of the book promises to those who will not believe in Muhammad. So as his life changes and as it becomes more violent, the writings in the Quran become more violent. Okay, the ones that he writes later, that's abrogation, supersede anything he said earlier. So this is progressing. Okay, that's really important to understand about the Quran. So that's what's going on. To fund his quest for control, Muhammad first directed his followers to raid Meccan caravans in the holy months when the victims would least expect it. The people around him gradually developed a lust for things that could be taken in battle, including material comforts and captured women and children. Muhammad defeated the Meccan army at Badr, which was a huge battle in the history of Islam, which emboldened him to begin dividing and conquering the three local Jewish tribes at Medina. Their mistake was to accept the Muslim presence but reject Muhammad's claim that he was in the line of Jewish prophets. So he was dealing with them. Ultimately, the Jews of Mecca were the first in a very long line of unfortunate people to be offered the opportunity to convert to Islam under obvious duress. Forcible conversion is very much a Muslim tradition started by Muhammad himself. That's what Muhammad would do. That's what ISIS is doing. Although the Quraza surrendered peacefully, that was one of the Jewish tribes, Muhammad determined to have every man of the tribe executed along with every boy that had reached the initial stages of puberty, somewhere between 12 and 14. He ordered a ditch dug outside of the town and had the victims brought in several groups. Each person would be forced to kneel and their head would be cut off and then dumped along with the body into the trench. Between 700 and 900 men and boys were slaughtered by the Muslims after their surrender. Sounds familiar. The surviving children of the men became slaves of the Muslims, and their widows became sex slaves. Also sounds familiar. From Medina, Muhammad waged a campaign of terror to which he openly attributed his success. That's in Bukhari 52:220. His gang of robbers launched raids in which hapless communities were savaged, looted, murdered, and raped. The tribes around the Muslims began to convert to Islam out of self-preservation. Sounds familiar. Muhammad's personal life became the picture of hedonism and excess, all justified by frequent revelations from an increasingly arbitrary and capricious God. In his later years, he frequently used his influence for purely personal goals, including sex, wealth, and power. Allah's authority for him to pursue these earthly ambitions is even immortalized in the Quran. That's in Surahs 33 and 66, particularly. Muhammad used eternal paradise and damnation to solicit strict obedience to his every command. Allah's apostle said, this is a quote, "Whoever obeys me will enter paradise, and whoever disobeys me will not enter it." Thus, you have martyr yourself to go to paradise. The only way a Muslim can know for sure that they will actually go there. In 628, 6 years after fleeing, Muhammad's followers were allowed to re-enter Mecca. He went in there with an agreement, but of course turned on them as well, and basically took over and just continued his reign of terror. In what could also become the model for future Muslim military conquests, those Meccans who would not convert to Islam were required to accept third-class status. Not surprisingly, almost the entire city, which had previously rejected his message, immediately converted to Islam once Muhammad came back with a sword in his hand. To this day, people of other religions are barred even from entering Mecca, the city where Muhammad was free to preach in contradiction to the established religion. Islam is far less tolerant even than the more primitive Arab religion that it supplanted. A person preaching the original Arab polytheism on the streets of Mecca today would be quickly executed. Tellingly, some of the most violent verses in the Quran were handed down following Muhammad's ascension to power when there was no threat to the Muslim people. The ninth surah of the Quran exhorts Muslims to jihad and dominance over other religions. So the later it was written, that supplants the earlier writings. You can find peaceful writings, but that's when he was in Mecca at the beginning. No problem. Off he goes to Medina. The war is going on. He's getting nutty. He's getting violent. And then the later writings are more violent, reflect that, but that supersedes the earlier stuff. Here's what it says in the ninth surah of the Quran. "Fight those who do not believe in Allah, nor in the latter day, nor do they prohibit what Allah and his messenger have prohibited, nor follow the religion of truth out of those who have been given the book," capital B, that's Christians, "until they pay the tax and acknowledgement of superiority and they are in a state of subjection." That's called the jizya, the tax you pay if they choose to allow you to live as a third-class citizen, still having to obey Sharia law there, but you can remain a Christian as long as you pay the tax. Okay? The verse that follows curses Christians and Jews by name and says, "May Allah destroy them." Muhammad died of a fever in 632 at the age of 63 with his violent religion spread over most of Arabia. Muhammad's failure to leave a clear successor resulted in a deep schism that quickly devolved into violence and persists to this day. That's the Sunni-Shia conflict, okay? Who's going to take the lineage? Who's going to take the throne of Muhammad next? And that's where you get the Sunni-Shia conflict. His own family fell apart and literally went to war with each other in the first few years. Thousands of Muslims were killed fighting each other in a battle between Muhammad's favorite wife, Aisha, and his adopted son, Ali. Infidels fared no better. Through Muhammad's teachings and example, his followers viewed worldly life as a constant physical battle between the House of Peace, which is called Dar al-Salam, and the House of War, Dar al-Harb. Muslims are instructed to invite their enemies to either embrace Islam, pay the jizya, which is basically protection money, or die. Sounds familiar. That's what's been happening in northern Iraq. Okay. Over the next 14 centuries, the bloody legacy of this extraordinary individual would be a constant challenge to those living on the borders of Islam's political power. The violence that Muslim armies would visit on peoples across North Africa, the Middle East, Europe, and into Asia, as far as the Indian subcontinent, is a tribute to a founder who practiced and promoted subjugation, rape, murder, and forced conversion. That's what Muhammad did. That's what ISIS is doing. Are they bad Muslims? Are they crazy Muslims? Are they radical? No. They're fundamental followers of Muhammad himself. In Muhammad's words, I have been ordered to fight the people till they say, none has the right to be worshipped but Allah. And if they say so, pray like our prayers, face our Qibla and slaughter as we slaughter, then their blood and property will be sacred to us and we will not interfere with them. That's from Bukhari 8:387. It is certainly the basis not just for modern day terror campaigns against Western infidels and Hindus and Buddhists and everybody else for that matter, but also the broad apathy that Muslims across the world have to violence, which is an obvious enabler. As Indonesian cleric Abu Bakar Bashir recently put it, if the West wants to have peace, then they have to accept Islamic rule. And that is the only way, friend, that you have peace with these fundamental Muslims who are strict followers of their founder, Muhammad. The only way to have peace with them is to join them. And if you don't join them, well, pay the tax or die. How do you deal with them? How do you deal with them? There's only one way, unfortunately, and that's to destroy them. This is Steve Noble, Call to Action Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, Call to Action Radio. I know that was a lot to go through, the really the quote-unquote highlights of Muhammad's life. From birth to death and the movement that he created as known as Islam. I just put up a link on Facebook. What I want to do there is I have a great, it's a 44-page PDF file called Islam 101, okay? And I just put a note up on my Facebook page. So you can go to our homepage at c2atoday.com and find me that way, or just go to the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/C2A radio, or send me an email. That's just c2atoday@yahoo.com. All that stuff's at the homepage, by the way, at c2atoday.com. That's the letter C, the number two, the letter A, c2atoday.com. Don't take my word for it. Read it yourself. But this document, this document entitled Islam 101, okay, Islam 101, 44 pages, PDF file, I'll send it to you, and read it for yourself. It goes over Sharia law. It goes over the history of Muhammad himself. It goes over Sunni-Shia differences, what the teachings are, and it gives you a very clear picture. Makes it even more troubling. We talked about our president on Wednesday this week of his obvious Muslim sympathies, but he's like 80% of the Muslims worldwide, which they really don't have a clue about the ins and outs of the religion because they haven't read the four different documents, starting with the Quran and the Hadith, that outline the whole thing, and particularly what Muhammad actually did. What would Jesus do? We know that. What would Muhammad do? We know that as well. So if you're going to be a follower of Muhammad, you would live like Muhammad lived, and ISIS is doing that. So when the president talks about, he refuses to call it Islamic terrorism and use the words, and so many people are, it's 60%+ of Americans think that Islam is a religion of peace. That's massive ignorance. And it's ignorance that's not just inconvenient. It's ignorance that's downright dangerous and deadly. That's why I will continue to talk about this, not every day, but regularly, especially when they're attacking Western civilization every other day, and if not every day. And you need to know the truth. And that gives some more weight to the Syrian refugee issue. And I had this whole talk yesterday with my Christian ethics class, high schoolers, high school age homeschoolers. We blew off the regular syllabus that we were supposed to do yesterday, and we talked about the Syrian refugee crisis. And one big question that came out of it is, why can't we help Syrian refugees as a nation but leave them over there? Why do you have to bring them here? And if 2% or 3% or 5% of 10,000 of them are dangerous and could kill you, how is that neighbor love? For here. Now, our government's first job is to protect its citizens. That's us. It's not to protect citizens in other countries. That's the government's job, is to protect us first and foremost. It's not to be the moral nice guy around the world. That's not their job. Their job, according to the U.S. Constitution, which we still live under for the most part, is to protect us. Now, if you want to talk about caring for the Syrian refugees, well, obviously God has a heart for the downtrodden, for the outcast, for the refugee, for the sojourner, for the alien, and that's our job. So don't whine about what the government's doing. We have to find ways to do something ourselves. So I'm going to research that over the weekend, and I'll put some options up on Facebook so that you can see, even if it's just finding some ministries that you can help support financially. If you have a burden for these people, and you should, because many of them, hopefully, are trustworthy, we can help them without bringing them here. Because you don't know. So if you bring 1,000 and five of them can be deadly and they kill 500, what are you doing? And it's not the government's right. It's not my right to endanger my neighbor's lives for me trying to help somebody. I can give my life for somebody else. That's the very definition of love according to the New Testament. I give my life to help my brother. I don't give your life to help that guy. And so if I bring somebody really dangerous into my midst, I better not do it with a bunch of other people around me because I'm not loving them well. That's not neighbor love. And so you have to be discerning here and don't mix these two spheres of what a Christian's called to do and what the government, the U.S. government is called to do, which is outlined in the U.S. Constitution, only a little bit in the Bible, which tells us in the New Testament that governments are ordained to punish the unrighteous and protect the innocent. That's what they're there for. That's how God instituted government. When you study the scriptures, that's what it's very obvious. And so sovereignty is important and borders are important and it's there to keep order and to fight back chaos. But the government's job, according to our Constitution, is not to run around the world and take care of everybody else. Their primary job is to take care of us. So please, it's great. We have to have a Christian heart and mind about the Syrian refugee crisis and the massive refugee crisis over there right now. But that's one thing. What the government's supposed to do is another. Okay, let's go to our friend David Fisher with the CEO of Landmark Gold, because the Congress is doing some things moving down the road. We've talked about this before, David, and welcome back to Call to Action. We talked about this before in terms of the bail-in, which has happened in 12 different countries around the world. And what, like the last 5 years? So remind us, David, just reintroduce yourself to the Call to Action audience and remind us about the bail-in and what's happened around the world. Welcome back to Call to Action, of course.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for having me on your program. I appreciate it, and I really enjoyed what you were sharing. Ignorance is convenient, and it is also deadly, and as Christians, I do believe, as you do, we need to know the truth, and the truth of the matter is the government wants your money because they don't have enough of it. We're $18 trillion in debt, and there's about $18 trillion in retirement accounts. Do the math, and there's a lot of information out there on the Internet saying this is what our country is actually wanting to do, and President Obama has set this all up. In fact, most recently, there's a fight between our government agencies who's going to control this money. They've already, in their minds, they've already decided to take the money. Now they're just going to say which entity of the government is going to manage it.
Because we have the notion out there, David, that people, you know, most of us are concerned about, should there be some oversight? Should the government be paying attention to what's happening in the financial world so that the robber barons of industry are not taking advantage of the little people? But we're not really talking about oversight here, are we? Aren't we talking more about the government doing what other governments have done around the world in the last 5 years by just literally taking their citizens' money?
You're exactly right. It has happened in 14 countries. Initially, I was saying 12 when I wrote this white paper earlier this year in January. But after doing more research, it's actually 14 countries: Argentina, Bulgaria, Hungary, France, Cyprus, Poland, Greece, Ireland, Italy, Australia, Iceland, and Spain and Portugal and Russia. So, I mean, I have all the data, how much they took, when they took it. All the countries were underfunded. They were overspent as a government. And they said the easiest way to get our books back in order and don't have to default is seize our citizens' pensions, retirements, and or bank accounts. And that is actually what has happened. In our country, there's actually more information that is of the setup for this thing called the bail-in there is in America than the 14 other countries combined. The IMF has been involved in this. They wrote a 107-page report on this. Our own FDIC, and this is on a government website, on the FDIC.gov, explaining how they now legally can do this in your retirement because this is a socialistic environment. And this is just the financial side of what we call the Obama health care plan, because all these 14 countries have a national health care system. So this is taking the money side to pay for the overspending and the possibly defaulting that the government wants to avoid. They got to get the money from somewhere, and they got to get it from their citizens.
Well, when you look at the situation, and we talk about, you know, $18, $19 trillion in debt right now, we're not even talking about over the next 20 to 30 years, another, some people say $70 trillion, some people say $125 trillion in unfunded liabilities with Social Security and Medicare and all the, and Medicaid and all the other things that are out there on the government dole. I think the government, isn't it logical to assume, David, that the government, they know this train wreck is coming. They know it's out there. They keep kicking the can down the street, but they know sooner or later they're going to have to find some money that they currently can't grab, and they're going to have to grab it essentially by force.
You're exactly right. Not only does our government know it, because they know what all the accounts that are unfunded liabilities that you're saying, and it can, the conservative number is $54 trillion. The aggressive numbers are the numbers that you're saying, which I think it's more reality what the numbers are, over $100 trillion. But more than just our country knowing it, five of the largest countries that have bought our U.S. dollars historically, which is China, Russia, Norway, Brazil, and Taiwan, have been purchasers of the U.S. dollar, called treasuries. And they've been aggressively purchasing our dollars for decades. But here's the problem. In 2013, they took a pause. They stopped buying treasuries for the first time in history. And actually, China stopped buying treasuries in 2005 for the first time. But all five countries, for the first time, did it together because they move in a pack. And in 2015, this year, according to the Treasury, which gathers reporting of selling of treasuries, and they've been gathering this data since the year 1978. So all these years from 1978 till now, Steve, we have had the largest sell-off in the dollar by these five largest countries ever in the history of the sell-off of the dollar this year, according to the Department of Treasury. So the problem is somebody has to hold the debt, because the Treasury bill is created by the overspending of our government. And President Obama obviously got his way again, and he has a massive overspending. The debt's going to be, national debt's going to be over $20 trillion when he leaves office 14 months from now. But somebody's got to hold the debt. And if the world is backing away from buying treasuries, somebody's got to buy it.
Right.
And that's where this bail-in comes.
And when we come back, we're talking to David Fisher, the CEO of Landmark Gold. It's landmarkgold.com. When we come back, we'll talk about the ramifications of the sell-off of dollars, and what can you do about it? I mean, how do you protect yourself? This is really serious, friends, and it's happened elsewhere. That's why we're talking about it. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, Call to Action Radio. Great to be with you today. Next week, I'll be broadcasting live from Florida. We're going down there for Thanksgiving, so I'll be in Florida next week, and I'll be broadcasting live Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Monday with a pastor down there has written just an incredible book. It's all about suffering and trials and tribulations and how to deal with that, looking at the life of Job. So we'll be doing that on Monday. Tuesday, Kellyanne Conway, who's just one of the most prolific and one of the most effective pollsters in America, just a brilliant woman, a Christian, a follower of Christ. And we're going to talk to her and get educated about the mushy middle. Who are the independents? Who are the independent voters? How much are they going to sway the election next year? So Kellyanne Conway on Tuesday, and then Wednesday will be a show really dedicated to Thanksgiving, the whole notion in and of itself, not just the holiday, but the notion in and of itself. I've got several things that I've written in the past, 66 things to be thankful for from the 66 books of the Bible, some other stuff like that. And we'll share that with you on Wednesday next week, live from Florida. But today, going down some difficult roads. Listen, I don't mean to be a harbinger of fear or anything like that, but radical, quote unquote, radical, which is actually just fundamental good Islamic fundamentalism, is the real deal. And it's ISIS is right at the tip of the spear, and they're not stopping with the Middle East. So if you want that resource, Islam 101, just go to the Facebook page or go to my homepage or send me an email at c2atoday@yahoo.com. So that's very serious. But we're also talking, to switch gears onto the financial side, with our friend David Fisher, who's the CEO of Landmark Gold. Their website, by the way, landmarkgold.com. LandmarkGold.com. And we're talking about something we've talked about previously on the show called a bail-in. We all know about the bailout that happened here in the United States of America as the government took our money to bail out a bunch of industries, banks and such. But the bail-in, which has now happened, David's research has shown this has happened in 14 different countries around the world where the government just seizes a portion of, well, our stuff, our money, in order to bail itself out. That's a bail-in. And so some things are happening in the American government to set that up so that they would be able to do that to us as well. And that's why we're talking to David Fisher about it today. LandmarkGold.com is the website. If you want to get that white paper, The Coming Bail-In, or also just call the phone number, which is 844-879-8882, or their website, LandmarkGold.com. And by the way, let me just clarify this. We're not doing this to hawk a product. David will give you information. It's just like the gospel. You share the gospel, you give the information, but what somebody does with that information is up to them. So when you deal with David and his folks there, and David and I have been talking for a while now, they're not there to wrangle you into anything. They're there just to share information with you, to educate you. What you do with it is up to you. If I didn't trust this brother in Christ, he wouldn't be on the show. But I do. I've gotten to know him, and he's helped educate me, and that's why we have him on again today to talk about this very serious situation. Again, David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Steve. You're exactly right. There's no pressure working with our company. And just a funny thing, right before I got on your program, I was talking with a lady who heard us from another national talk show radio host, another Christian one, and she got our packet, and so we were talking for the actually myself with her for the first time, and I made that very clear. There's no pressure. And as she began to share with me her financial situation, I shared with her, I said, you know, I don't want to say her name. Well, I'll say her first name. Her first name was Lorraine. I said, Lorraine, this really isn't for you. It's not going to benefit you. And I go, and that's really who we are, Steve. I'll tell a person, and I've done this in 22 years of being in the industry, what is in their best interest, and they process that information with their own way of making decisions.
Yeah, yeah. And so before we hit the break, David, you were telling us about the massive sell-off in the dollar this year from the big five countries that have been buying our treasuries. But bring that back to us now. Well, how does that affect us? How does that affect our future as American citizens and as investors in dealing with our retirement money predominantly? And then what do we do about it? We have to kind of look at defensive measures here.
Well, somebody has to be left holding the bag. They call it the bigger fool theory, as they say. Just like when a stock is bought and the stock is sold, that money exchanges hand. For there to be a buyer, there has to be a seller. And for that transaction to happen, there's a two-way market, if you will. When there is a massive sell-off in the dollar, somebody has to buy it. And that's what supports the debt structure. When we go into debt and we spend more money as a country, they issue a treasury bill. So if nobody's buying the treasury bill, then Americans are going to get forced to buy the treasury bill. And that's why you saw this new retirement program being rolled out called the MIRA. The only asset you can buy in the MIRA program is treasuries. Yet President Obama announced it in his State of the Union address in 2014. He didn't roll it out until just 2 weeks ago. Why the wait? Because the information just came out about this massive sell-off in the dollar. So he's reacting to that. So this whole thing of called a bail-in forces people into their government seizing their retirement account, which puts that money into a treasury, and they even got a name for it. It's called the Guaranteed Retirement Annuity. It's a government annuity. And they pay you back. It's like a Social Security program that they've got set up over time. But according to the International Monetary Fund report on this bail-in that they're suggesting America should do, which is the same suggestion that they've done with these 14 other countries, that for America, that report is interpreted between 56 to 71%. So imagine your retirement. All your listeners right now, think of your retirement. Think of your savings account. The government taking 56 to 71%. And saying that's ours now to help support the indebtedness of our country. Jeez. We're going to give you a fund to pay you back over time, and this is why it won't cause an upheaval, but this is what our government has set up. They're just trying to figure out which agency is going to monitor this. Is it going to be the Department of Labor? Is it going to be the Treasury?
Yeah, which I know has been going on in Congress as to where to put the oversight of it, and of course that becomes the trigger, man. So what can we possibly do in defense? Take defensive measures. Is there anything we can do about it?
Well, absolutely. God's called us to be good stewards of the funds that He's entrusted with us, and He says apportion to seven, apportion to eight, because we do not know what tragedy may befall us. Because, well, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, and no one knows that. But what we do know is there's significant amount of information that has paved the way for what we're talking about. And that's why they need to get this report. They can read it with their very own eyes. They can even Google it and find all the research that I've done. But we put together a simple report. So how they protect themselves is there's a method that was been devised, and it actually started in 1997 through the Taxpayer Relief Act, the bill that was passed became law, where you can roll over your retirement into physical precious metals and take possession of them, hold them in your hands, under the umbrella of a retirement, and still not have a tax liability. Now, in the industry, my industry, Steve, most companies, I'd say only about 85%, have not figured this thing out yet, this part here. When you roll over your retirement into precious metals, the metals is held in a third-party depository. You never see it and never hold it.
Right.
There's a lawyer that has developed this plan, and there's about 15%, and the number is going to probably double next 2 or 3 years, where multiple companies will have figured this thing out. But I've been doing this for the last 5 years, where I've helped thousands of people roll over their retirement and take physical possession, hold the metals in their hands without tax liability. So if the government goes the route that they're saying that looks like they're going to do, and they flip the switch and try to seize your account, they can't access this because you're not in paper anymore. You're in physicals.
Oh, got it. Okay.
So you're safe. That's your insurance policy. Gold might be a great investment, too, if they choose to raise interest rates, because eventually they're going to have to do that, attract new money to hold the dollars.
Right.
That's the incentive. There will be inflation.
Yeah, and I mentioned that, David, at the beginning of the show, that we'll have you back on a little closer to December 15th when they're supposed to make another announcement, the Fed is, about interest rates. But in terms of bringing up gold, I mean, when you look up at the price of gold, and I'm looking at a chart here that's got a five-year rolling average of the price of gold, where it was really high back in late 2011, and it was up, you know, over $1,800 an ounce. Now it's down to less than $1,100 an ounce. Should we look at gold in this case in terms of an investment, or just kind of a way to protect some portion of our assets against what the government very likely could do in the future?
Right now, gold is an insurance policy. It's not an asset class that's performing significantly, although I would say this, that CNBC wrote an article here about a month ago that's saying, because there's one market in gold is not all the markets in gold. There's multiple markets in gold, and that's one thing that we do is educate people. But CNBC said that there was a physical certain market in gold that has moved 13% so far this year, and this was the article that came out last month, and in the last 5 years has gone up 92%. So there's lots of different types of gold markets that do, physical gold markets that do different things. But I would look at gold more as a safety valve with against government and seizure and a hedge. But also it could possibly be your number one portfolio of an investment class that's coming up with what's happening. Because if they do a bail-in, gold will go up. If they raise interest rates, gold will go up. So they're going to have to do one or the other or a combination of both.
Yeah. Yeah, did you, I mean, in your 20-plus years of experience, David, did you ever foresee or think that we would be to a point in the United States of America that we are now financially?
No. In fact, it took me 3 years of fighting internally with myself, of finally breaking down and coming to the conclusion, I got to write this report. There's way too much information out there, and we got to get it out. And that's why I'm so, if you hear my emotion and my animation and my excitement, I'm scared.
Yeah.
This is the first time I've ever, in the last 3 months, I'm finally saying America is bankrupt. We just have not filed the paperwork. And I've been doing radio for 22 years. I've never said it until the last 3 months.
Yeah.
We are in trouble financially.
Trouble, huge trouble, and really not to, like, and I appreciate you said this earlier, David, not primarily for ourselves, but for our posterity, for our children and grandchildren. We need to be very, very wise here, and that's why we had David Fisher on the show today. David, again, from Landmark Gold, thank you so much for your help, brother. It's a huge blessing to all of us. 844-879-8882 or landmarkgold.com to get that white paper so you can get educated, so you can be wise. David Fisher, thanks, brother. God bless you.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, have a happy Thanksgiving. Friends, God willing, I'll talk to you on Monday.